You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today. Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network. Today on the James Altucher Show.
You know, whenever you feel frustrated in life, and whenever you look around and you say, what is going on? Your life is crazy. You have to kind of go back internally and just rationally ask yourself, well, where can I find meaning in my life? That's what I get out of your book. I think a lot of people sit there sipping their coffee, reading the newspaper, and thinking, you know, I'm going to be really active about climate change.
Yeah.
They come up with this artificial thing that's going to provide meaning for them. Like, what would you prescribe about how you can find some meaning?
Well, so this is a little bit of the paradox of hope that I talk about, is that one of the things that generates hope for us is conflict. When you create a society that's devoid of serious conflict, when nobody's life is threatened, our brain naturally starts seeking conflict because that's the easiest way to generate hope.
You make this distinction between the thinking brain and the feeling brain. So the thinking brain can say, intellectually, I know I need to find hope, I need to find meaning, but I think it takes a lot of practice for that feeling brain to really sort of absorb this message and do it.
Oh yeah, we're all messed up, you know?
Got Mark Manson wants to get on the podcast. You probably know him from The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. It's a great book. Mark, we're going to get into your new book, which is Everything is Fucked, a book about hope. You kind of created the genre of, and I'm sure people have told you this, but now like every book on the bestseller list has the word either fuck or shit in it.
I'm a trendsetter.
You're like the fuck tire genre is all you. And I'm sorry for using these words so much on the podcast, but that's the book. It's the subtle art of not giving a fuck.
It's my fault. It's my fault.
Exactly. If just out of curiosity, this is a random thing. If people try to search for your book, do they have to do F*CK on Amazon?
I'm pretty sure fuck will get them to it.
All right.
Yeah.
And here's the other question. Amazon now keeps track of not only the best-selling books, but the books that people read the most. You know, often you buy a book and you don't read it. But, you know, on the Kindle now, Amazon could see how many pages people read a book. And your book is often at the near the top of the books actually people read.
Yeah.
Did that surprise you? Like, you're out of the million books published last year, yours is in the top five of the ones people actually read.
I will say, for like all the, I guess, accolades and achievements that the book has had, that's probably one of the ones that feels the best, because it validates the writing. You know,
yeah.
it tells you that it's like people get sucked into it and they want to keep going. So as a writer, that feels good.
Like, Amazon also keeps track of the number of highlights each passage gets.
Yep.
What's your most highlighted passage and how many highlights does it get?
Oh, I haven't checked in like a year or two, but I think the last time I checked, it was like 10,000 or something like that.
And what was the passage?
It was something in the first chapter. I can't remember. It's funny, man, because I've barely even looked at that book in like the last 2 years. Like, I don't know what it is.
I know the feeling, yeah.
Yeah.
You just get tired of it. Like, first you had that article from your blog that just blew up and viral.
Yeah.
And then you got the calls, hey, make a book out of this. And then it became huge. And you have, I'm going to give you some compliments. You have a very authentic, raw writing style, like you don't give a fuck. but it's very good because it's not just sort of you angrily lecturing people.
Sure.
You're telling stories.
Yeah.
And so in this book, Everything is Fucked, a book about hope, I really like how you tell all these interesting stories on each chapter. Like, I would almost say, I'm going to give you an exaggerated praise, but it's sort of correct. This is like a modern day Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning.
Oh, dude.
So I'm not saying you survived the Holocaust. His book is a timeless classic, which maybe this book will be too. But there's this is like sort of a reminder, you know, whenever you feel frustrated in life and whenever you look around and you say, what is going on here? Life is crazy. You have to kind of go back internally and just rationally ask yourself, well, where can I find meaning in my life? That's what I get out of your book.
Absolutely. Well, it is a book about meaning. You know, I kind of use the concept of hope, but really what hope is this idea that something in the future is important or worth living for. And so a lot of the book kind of just investigates how our psychology constructs these ideas of hope for ourselves, which gives us a sense of meaning.
A lot of it is, you know, I forgot who says the quote. Steve Cohen, my podcast producer, is the quote machine.
Hi, Mark. But,
hey.
Have you met Steve yet?
Yeah, we met him first time he's here.
You know, so there's a quote, it's never the problem, it's your perception of the problem. Steve,
the problem isn't the problem, the problem is your perception of the problem.
Who says that quote?
I've heard different people say it, Tony Robbins.
You never know these days with quotes.
Yeah.
Like, it could be, there's a whole, you can go down Google rabbit holes.
Yeah.
I liked, you said something like, certainty is the opposite of growth or something?
Yeah. Yeah, something like that. Certainty is the opposite of growth. Or as long as you're certain, you can't change. You can't grow.
Which is also related to the concept of beginner's mind.
Like, yes.
You know, no matter how old you are, no matter how much of an expert you are, always get back to beginner's mind to find that initial glee of doing something, that initial curiosity, mm-hmm. the sense of humility that you can keep on growing no matter. But anyway, so, you know, meaning.
Yes.
What drove you to do this, though?
Well, it's funny because, I'd say two things happened between Subtle Art and writing this one. First,
you're on my podcast twice. I know that was very important.
Yeah, well, it was extremely life-changing both times.
Yes.
But it's, you know, I always tell people that my books, I see writing, and I think you're the same way. For me, writing is like a public form of therapy. You know, it's like, it's how I sort through my shit, and I try to do it in a format that other people can read it and hopefully get something out of it. So for me, the struggles that kind of led to this book is two things. One was Subtle Art came out in end of 2016, and it just blew the doors off of everything. I think it's actually just heard yesterday. It's past 8 million copies now.
That is unbelievable.
Which is like...
Because, you know, I can't think of people... I'm not going to say this in a bad way.
Yeah.
But what I've noticed in general is that people don't... I hate to say people don't read, because that makes it seem like people are getting less intelligent, which is not true. It's just that people do other things. People watch TED Talks. People listen to podcasts. People watch YouTube videos. So there's many more things for people to do. So I don't know that many nonfiction books like yours that really break out. You know, if you think of things like Freakonomics or The 4-Hour Workweek or Malcolm Gladwell's books, those were written in the 2000s, and they all sort of broke out in kind of the literary nonfiction or self-help kind of category to have millions of copies. I don't know any others other than yours after a certain time that has really sold millions of copies.
Yeah, it's kind of like it only happens a few times a decade, I think, that a book is like this big. It's been number one in 13 countries, which is also mind-blowing. So all this stuff started happening in 2017. And, you know, and it's one of those things where it's, you work your ass off for 10 years, you have all these dreams and hopes and ideas of like what you want your life to be. You know, in my mind, I was going to work for 20, 30 years and just knock off all these kind of dreams that I had as an author. And Subtle Art just knocked them out in like 3 months. You know, so suddenly I'm sitting around in 2017 and I'm like, oh shit, I don't know what to do anymore.
And did you feel this urge, because you knew that you could keep feeding this, I don't, what do you call it? Not the monster that you created, but you could just keep feeding this enormous vacuum of interest in your stuff by just writing the same thing over and over again. Did you feel that urge?
I didn't at all. My publisher absolutely did. So, you know, one of the first things my publisher said to me is like, how about Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck for teens? How about Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck for parents, you know? I was like, no, I'm not going to do...
Good for you.
Yeah, I don't want... I'm still young. I've got a lot of books in me. Like, I don't want to get pigeonholed into this brand.
So all you kept was the fucked.
Yeah.
In the next book.
Yeah, that was kind of the compromise.
Yeah.
Was like, all right, I'll give you guys an F word in the title. But yeah, so I actually spent much of that year kind of just not knowing what to do with myself. Played a lot of video games, took the wife on some trips. But it was strange because I actually was more depressed that year than I think any year since I was in college.
What is it? What do you mean? Like, were you sad, depressed? Were you not finding pleasure in things? Like, were you anxious because you didn't know what to do next? Like, what does it mean?
So this is actually one of the things that I explained in the first chapter of the book, is that a lot of people assume that depression is sadness. And I think that's just because depression most often occurs when something tragic happens in our lives. But really what depression is it's not finding meaning in something. Like it's when you enter this state where it's difficult to know what the point of doing anything is. And so I reached that point, but it was really bizarre because whereas most people come to a place of meaninglessness through loss, you know, it's like a family member dies or they lose their job or whatever. I came to it through like success, like astronomical success. I had all these dreams for my life. I had visions of who I wanted to be as an author, what I was going to work the next 20 years for. And by achieving it so quickly, all those things were taken away from me. And so, again, I kind of lost this sense of meaning in my life. But it's a really weird thing because then you can't really talk to people about it because then you look like an asshole. Like, they're like, dude, you just sold 2 million books. Like, what are you complaining about? I'm like, no, really. Like, I don't know why I should get out of bed in the morning. So it was very disorienting. And it led me into researching a lot of these concepts and topics, these ideas of hope. Like, you need something to hope for. You need something to look forward to. You need some vision of how your life can be better. And that wasn't clear for me at that time. So that was the first thing that informed this book. And the second thing that informed it is, I don't want to, you know, I don't think either of us wants to talk about politics, but the 2016 election, regardless of who you prefer, I think everybody kind of agrees that the 2016 election like broke the internet. Like, 2016 was the year that everybody was like, oh, wait, the internet makes some things really bad.
And just to add to that, I think that was the first time we realized, you know, oh, I hate people on the internet because of their beliefs. We're all in our like air-conditioned homes with our minivans parked outside and we all have clean water and everything's great. But now I hate people on the internet.
That I've never met, I'm never going to meet. And they're evil and they're pieces of shit. And so it was such an ugly, that election was just so ugly for everybody. And that ugliness has continued over the years. And one thing that was fascinating for me when I was traveling around the world promoting subtle art was I noticed that this was happening all over. And it was funny actually because usually the countries that my book was number one in, they had some sort of political crisis going on. And they had the same polarization and they had the same like social media frenzy of just people being hysterical and hating each other. And I was like, wow, like something really, you know, people like to dogpile on Facebook and you know, there's all sorts of scapegoats. But it really got me thinking that there is something fundamentally different about this technology and the way it affects us psychologically. And it's not necessarily like, you know, it's not necessarily like, oh, kids who use their phones too much like get depressed. Like I think it changes the way we process meaning in our lives, and it makes it more difficult to find hope. Like you said, it's like we're all sitting in an air-conditioned room with our minivans outside, sitting there on our phones, hating people that we don't even know. And there's such an avalanche of information coming into our minds that we don't really, that vision of what to hope for gets muddied and becomes convoluted.
Yeah, and you know, and it reminds me, like, at least once a day, I have to remind myself, don't argue with this person on the internet. Like someone will say something, usually about me, or about something I've done or something I've said or tweeted or Facebook, and they'll say something that's either wrong or insulting or rude, and I don't know them. They're like a complete stranger.
Yeah.
If there was no internet, I would never know they existed. And yet I like hit the reply button and I'm about... Every day, I'm about to reply. My hands are over the keyboard, and I have to say to myself, "No, this is not going to add to my life." But it's weird. Even though knowing that, I still have to remind myself of that every day.
Yeah. Well, and you know what's crazy too is that if you actually like when I go out and do events and I actually meet these people, we're nice to each other. Like I've run into people in person at events who are like, "I really disagree with this part of your book," or I have these different beliefs and they challenge me on stuff. And we're actually like super respectful to each other and we get along fine. There's just something about the medium that I think oversimplifies or overcompresses our empathy, or like our ability to connect with each other. I think one thing I say in the book is that all the technological innovation of the last couple decades, we basically traded out quality of connection for quantity of connection. And really it's quality of connection that gives our lives a sense of meaning. It's we need intimacy, we need trust. And for whatever reason, the internet and the media landscape it creates break those things down.
I wonder if it's, you know, people say something like, you know, 93% of communication is, and I don't know how they get these percentages, but 93% of communications is nonverbal.
Yeah.
And so when you throw in the internet, which is not even verbal, but just text, maybe you're missing out 98% of communication. And that's why there's so little kind of emotional or quality content to it. Add in the anonymity and, you know, in many cases, and then add in emojis. So if somebody, like your kind of emotions are determined a little bit, by the language you use, which is why, you know, when Mao took over China and it became communist China, he would drastically limit the words you can use. So it would change the way you think about things. And that's how he would, you know, suppress people and have control. And emojis, we've like voluntarily limited our language and our emotional responses. And I always think like, you know, it's always weird. Like you see these Facebook posts like, oh, my grandma, my bubby died. She was 97 years old. She lived such a great life. I miss her so much. And again, I'm like reaching for the sad emoji. Like, and I have to remind myself, that's not a normal response. Like,
yeah, yeah.
You know, so, you know, often I'll try to actually either write an email, like, I'm really sorry for your loss. But I'm also tempted to say, to actually comment like, you know, I knew her, she deserved it.
Yeah.
Like just something, just to take yourself out of the emoji, like gut response.
It's funny because I actually just recently wrote an article called Is Nobody Safe from the Bullshit? And I used a bunch of examples from just people in my life that I know of situations like that. Like I had a friend who, her father was like really religious. And all he did is he went on Facebook. You know, he's one of these old guys who posts on Facebook twice a year. And it was Easter. And so he went online. He went on Facebook and he was like, hey, everybody, I just want to wish everybody a happy Easter. God bless you all. And like the first comment was like, oh, yeah, promoting a religion that's like slaughtered millions and blah, 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 blah. And she was like, oh, my God. Like, it's just my dad's the sweetest old man, and he just loves Easter, and he just wanted to say happy Easter. And it's like—
Well, he learned his lesson.
Yeah, I know, right? It's like he'll never be on Facebook again. But it's insane, like, how— there's some weird combination of like dehumanization of the person on the other side, the ease of like the lack of consequences of just being a dick. You know, you would never say that to somebody's face. Like, right. Even if
but it happens every day, all day long. Like, millions,
yeah.
Like this. Like, I mean, I can think of an example from an hour ago. You know, I had an email where, if you don't like my daily email, you can opt in for my weekly email.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just saw, because you see, you know, you click on notifications, you see every time you're mentioned on Twitter, and someone wrote back, I bet you're not surprised I didn't even opt in for your weekly email. And I'm like, I don't even know who you are. Like, he's like a 3-follower. He is nobody to me. And like, yeah. He's acting like we have this big relationship. Now I'm going to be angry at him, which I was actually.
Yeah, right.
So
it's so bizarre.
I see also there's like this evolution in the writing. In this one, I think you did that same self-exploration, and then you added also all these other stories of heroism and meaning and so on. And I feel like it's an evolution as a writer where you're kind of interweaving your own story with all these other intense stories that I didn't know about from history. And there was a lot of great storytelling in this. Do you feel you evolved as a writer for this?
Absolutely. And it's funny kind of tying that into, you know, a question I'm getting a lot now is did you feel pressure to top subtle art? Or like, did you feel a lot of pressure to mimic, you know, just kind of like take the same style and tone? And yeah, that actually there was a lot of pressure.
And I don't think you did mimic the tone.
No. And it's eventually what I decided, I kind of agonized about it, but I realized I'm like, you know what? Things like subtle art happen once a decade in publishing. Like, just let it go. It's not going to happen again. You know, write a book that you're proud of. Write a book that you think is better, and then fuck the sales. And so that's what I did. And I feel like I did it. I feel like I became a better writer. I think it's more mature. It's more intellectual, which isn't something else I was kind of going for. And I'm really proud of it.
Yeah, I thought it was great. So many, you know, each chapter had so many stories. Like, it was almost like a text on a history of philosophy also.
Yeah.
And I don't mean text in a bad way, because it's the Mark Manson version of a history of philosophy. But I learned all these. I wasn't a philosophy major. I haven't really read a lot of philosophy. I learned about all these like historical philosophers in the context of the points you were trying to make from your own life. And it was really fascinating, like all the stuff about Kant, Nietzsche. I don't know how to say his name.
Yeah, Nietzsche.
And, you know, and then there were some things that I outlined. You know, you have this story of Pilecki, the guy who, you know, essentially breaks into Auschwitz, escape, you know, tries to save everybody, escapes from Auschwitz when he realizes he can't. And you have this one line, being heroic is the ability to conjure hope where there is none. And I think that's kind of a central theme of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you can...
Yeah, it comes back to that it comes back to the Frankl thing. I mean, that need to create meaning in your life, and that when you don't have that vision of some better future, of something to hope for, you just feel lost, and everything begins to feel meaningless. And so it's almost a skill to be able to take your situation and find something, find hope in it somehow, because that hope is what's going to generate the sense of meaning.
And how do you do that? Because I think and again, you make this distinction between the thinking brain mm-hmm. and the feeling brain. So the thinking brain can say, intellectually, I know I need to find hope, I need to find meaning, but I think it takes a lot of practice for that feeling brain to really sort of absorb this message and do it.
Oh yeah, we're all messed up. You know, it's a long process, because what we don't realize, you know, like you said, intellectually we understand that I lack meaning in my life, but ultimately, feeling a sense of meaning or having a sense of hope in your life, it's an emotional project. You can't like think yourself to importance. You have to like feel importance, and so that's the difficult part. That's the tricky part. And if our emotional brain or our unconscious or whatever you want to call it is bogged down with all sorts of baggage and trauma and whatnot, it makes it even harder. So a lot of kind of producing these visions of hope for ourselves is about resolving a lot of our assumptions, and then also a lot of like our emotional baggage.
But also I think, and this kind of is an extension of what you're saying when you make the distinction between the thinking brain and the feeling brain, thoughts aren't going to really do anything for you. Like they're sort of invisible, and you could just sit here and do nothing but think a lot.
Yeah.
And so even in this quote, you know, and in the story of Pilecki is a good example, when you say, you know, being heroic is the ability to conjure hope where there is none, I think there's an additional part there which says, you know, not only conjure hope where there is none, but actually then take action based on that. So the story you mentioned, Pilecki, he breaks into Auschwitz. You know, he's proactive, he takes action. Because the other way of being a hero is to be in a bad situation and find your way out. He was not in Auschwitz. He wasn't in the worst situation. He took this extreme action, and that made him a hero.
Yeah, I've been wanting to write about him for years because I think I even say in the book that his story is the most heroic thing I've ever come across in my life. So people who aren't, I'll give like the quick 30-second version. He was a Polish soldier when Poland was invaded in World War II by the Soviets and the Nazis at the same time. He helped start an underground guerrilla fighter network. And as part of that network, they wanted to infiltrate Auschwitz. And they didn't know what Auschwitz was at the time. They actually thought it was a prisoner of war camp at first. So there was a bunch of Polish soldiers there. So the idea was like, if we can sneak into Auschwitz, break a bunch of these Polish soldiers out, you know, we can get a lot more men fighting back against the Nazis. So Pilecki snuck in successfully, got there and was like, holy crap, like this is way worse than anybody could have imagined. So he was there during the Holocaust, and he actually organized espionage networks to get messages out, to get supplies in.
How was he able to do that without getting caught?
It's MacGyver type stuff. So like the messaging system, he somehow, he would sneak like small paper notes into the lining of the linens in the laundry baskets, because apparently the laundry was done outside of Auschwitz. So he would get notes into the linens, and then people at the laundromat outside in the town would pull them out and then pass them on to whoever in the Polish military. So he was the first person to alert the world to the Holocaust. He got intelligence out, and it eventually worked its way to London, like 1942. And the crazy thing is that every step along the chain of command, when the intelligence came in, they were like, oh, this guy's exaggerating. Like that can't be had. Tens of thousands of Jews a day? No, that's not happening. That's too many. So nobody took him seriously. And then by 1944, he realized that he needed to get out. And so he's one of, I think, only 44 people ever escaped the concentration camp. So he's the only person who's ever willingly gone to a concentration camp, and he's one of 44 people who successfully escaped a concentration camp.
So, but that's the sort of situation where deep down, he had this meaning that he discovered for himself that he knew he had to act on. I think a lot of people sit there in their, you know, sipping their coffee, reading the newspaper, and thinking, you know, I'm going to be really active about climate change. And yeah, they come up with this artificial thing that's going to provide meaning for them. Like, what would you prescribe if you were going to be prescriptive about how you can kind of like shuffle around in your internal mess and find some meaning?
Well, so this is a little bit of the paradox of hope that I talk about, is that one of the things that generates hope for us is conflict. So it was actually easy for Pulaski to find meaning and hope because he either did that or he died. You know, he had no choice. By feeling as though we're attacked by something, it immediately gives us something to hope for.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a 3-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a 3-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers, and he waited a little too long, and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast, and the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 bacon bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the bacon cheese slider, 1921 bacon cheese slider, or chicken bacon ranch slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 bacon bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
In your case, when you were feeling depressed over your success, which, by the way, you don't have to feel guilty about, there was suddenly that's the paradox of success too.
Sure.
Is that there? You always feel like you need more of something, and that's just being human.
Yeah,
and it has nothing to do with money or goals or whatever.
Yeah,
was that the conflict that drove you to do this research and start writing this book?
Well. So I'm going to tie it in a different way. I'm going to bring it back to the social media thing. I think one of the things I talk about is that when you create a society that's devoid of serious conflict, when nobody's life is threatened, when everything, you know, we're all sitting in air conditioners with minivans, our brain naturally starts seeking conflict because that's the easiest way to generate hope. To bring it back to my personal situation, you know, I don't think I necessarily went looking for conflict, but it's just I rediscovered what I'm passionate about, which is essentially analyzing and digging into a lot of human psychological tendencies and then explaining them. That's just always what I've loved. It's what I get super excited about. So for me, this, you know, getting all messed up about this stuff gave me an opportunity to go learn about it and discover, like, what was my brain doing? Why was it doing that, and how could this help other people?
And I think this underlines an important point, which is that everything is content.
Yes.
Like if you, you know, let's say you're an alcoholic and you black out and you wake up on the street and someone's peeing on you, you can either think, gosh, things can't get any worse, or you can think, this is content.
It'd be a great stand-up routine.
Yeah, this is a story of where you have to, like, figure your way out how to have a better life.
Yeah,
like,
bottom. It could be your rock bottom, exactly. Right. I mean, that's, so when back to the thinking and feeling brain, even though, as you pointed out, our feeling brain gets to decide when we feel motivated and when we don't, our thinking brain's superpower is that it gets to decide what our experiences mean, what they signify. So, you know, yeah, you get peed on by a homeless guy, you're going to feel awful. And your thinking brain's immediate impulse is going, you know, probably be self-loathing, like, oh my God, look how awful my life is. But you always have that opportunity to rewrite the meaning of your experiences, to say, like, you know what? This is probably rock bottom.
So let's say someone's not in rock bottom and not at this peak of success where they don't know what to do next. Let's say someone's driving into work for the 30th year in a row.
Sure.
And there's kind of this just simmering, low-level depression, like, I don't really like my boss, but I'm 4 years away from retiring or 15 years away from retiring.
Yeah.
And how do they start to you know, they have three kids, mortgage, they don't want to take too many chances. What's kind of a next step or two for them?
Well, what you're describing is a lack of hope. I mean, if you're in a dead-end job for 30 years, the reason it feels like a dead-end job is because you don't see any positive future out of it. You know, the trick is then to find what is something that you can hope for. And you don't have to, you know, a lot of people, they'll get their hope from their family. They'll get their hope from their church. They'll get their hope from their hobbies. You know, and so the job just kind of becomes a means to an end. But if you're not getting hope anywhere, you know, it's like if you got a dead-end job and your kids don't want to talk to you and you don't have any hobbies and your friends are lame, like then it starts to become a very dark place that's hard to get out of. So in terms of like finding hope, it's like you said, it's you have to like get out there and try something different. You have to take some sort of risk, even if it's not like a major risk. But it could be something as simple as trying a new hobby, you know, putting yourself out there, picking up the phone, calling your kids, being like, hey, we never talk. Like, I wish we would talk more often. It's going to hurt, but like, those are the things that you have to do that to give you that opportunity of improving. I mean, again, that's the paradoxical thing is that it's by experiencing pain that gives us something to hope for, and that hope gives our life a sense of meaning.
It's interesting because people usually think, oh, the goal is to be happier and happier and happier, but that's almost the opposite of what's going to make you happy, because what you're describing is you have to sort of get out of your comfort zone. And by definition, the comfort zone is where you're comfortable.
Yeah.
Outside of the comfort zone is where you're not happy and where you're uncomfortable. So like you say, it's going to hurt sometimes.
Yes.
But that's how you punch your way through to find a bigger comfort zone and to find other things where you might find hope or meaning.
Yeah, it's pain. We need some amount of pain in our lives to give us a sense of value and importance. Because it's the thing that makes our life feel meaningful and important is the idea that we've sacrificed for something. So if you're never sacrificing, if you're never giving anything up, if you're just feeling great all the time, it very quickly feels meaningless and pointless because you haven't sacrificed for anything. There's no, you know, if you suddenly died, there's no evidence that you were here, that you did anything impactful or meaningful. So it's a counterintuitive thing. And I think so much of our culture today revolves around increasing comfort and increasing pleasantness, that we're actually robbing ourselves of these opportunities to generate meaning.
Yeah. So what do you think will happen in a future where, you know, even more than ever, all of our needs are basically satisfied? And, you know, I think it was in your book or some, if not this book, I apologize. Some book I've read recently but I'm pretty sure it's a book, loneliness, you know, even though we have everything, yeah, loneliness is higher than ever in the United States. Like people say they're lonely, greater than 50% of people say they're lonely.
Yes. Yeah. So it's funny, the last chapter in the book, I kind of go on this like wild fantasy ridden rant about AI and what's going to happen. Like if we can cure all of our pain, I actually think the argument I make in my book is that, you know, this is everything we're describing about the necessity of conflict to generate hope, the necessity of pain to generate a sense of value and meaning in our life. Like, this is not a bug of our psychology. It's a feature. Like, we evolve this way because it's this constant cycle of finding something to hope for, pursuing it, fighting for it, and then struggling and feeling pain throughout the process. Like, that is what has gotten our species to like where it is today. So I kind of go on this crazy little thing where I say, like, you know, one day the AI is going to take over and we're all going to be living in the cloud and everything's going to be amazing. But I don't think, unless we like physically start altering our neurology, like we're not going to, there's never going to be a state of like pure bliss, like absolutely internal happiness. Like, it's whatever reality morphs into, there's going to continue to be that cycle of hope, conflict, pain, sacrifice meaning, and it's just going to keep going and going and going.
So you would say, so like, after people read this book, read all the stories, read the different philosophies, read your journey, maybe the first step is to start thinking of little ways to kind of what's going to make you a little uncomfortable, but you want to do. Like, what would be a first exercise or a second exercise?
Well, I think the important thing is to actually do something. You know, it's like you said, you can sit around on the couch all day and worry about climate change and read a bunch of articles and post angry tweets. But like, get up, go volunteer somewhere, like go clean up a riverbed, go organize fundraisers. You know, it's so much of our emotional state is attached to our behavior. And we don't realize, because we're so intellectually stimulated by the technology, we don't realize how sedentary our bodies have become. And so if we're not actually out there face-to-face looking at somebody like, hey, man, let's clean this shit up. Like, our neighborhood's going to be a little bit better because we spent an hour doing that. Like, that is what actually gives, like, it gives us sustenance psychologically.
And it's not just the doing something like cleaning up the community, because, okay, that's great.
Sure.
Picking up some garbage in the street cleans the community, makes it a little better. But you're making a small dent in mm-hmm. the general well-being of the community. But you're connecting with other people face to face. And I think that's who are like-minded and or maybe even different-minded, and you learn from them. And I think that's the real benefit, is kind of breaking out of who you're in contact with, solving that loneliness issue.
Yeah. I think the another side effect of kind of the internet and everything is I think maybe we think too globally now. Mm. You know, it's good to understand everything on a global level, but if we're not, it also makes us feel disempowered. You know, it's like, what the hell am I going to do? You know, China's not doing anything, so what the hell am I going to do? Whereas if you focus more locally and you focus on the people around you, it's much easier to see the impact you're having, see the value in your sacrifices, and create a healthy sense of hope.
I totally agree. And I also think that's a good way to practice in small and daily ways this idea of trying to find meaning and learning what the meaning is for you.
Yeah.
So I just want to add also that your notes at the end are, a lot of times I kind of skip the notes. You know, but I noticed you're writing a lot of you were quoting a lot of things, and so I read through the notes. These notes are just as valuable as reading the book. Like, you put a lot of thought into writing the notes. So I encourage people to read that. I encourage people to read the book, Everything is Fucked, a book about hope. I was about to say A Book Without Hope by Mark Manson. What's your next project?
I'm doing Will Smith's book.
He's doing like an autobiography or whatever he is.
Yeah, we're doing a memoir. It's like probably like 2/3 memoir, 1/3 self-help, mm-hmm. life advice.
And how did you get that? Like, he called you like, hey, Mark.
Not exactly. I mean, I guess in Will Smith world, it was the equivalent of calling me being like, hey, Mark, what's up? But it involved me like going through 6 different gatekeepers over 6 months and then finally getting to meet him in person. And
him reaching to you, or you trying to reach to him?
His team reached out to me.
Okay, great. And was that like, oh my gosh, Will Smith reached out to me?
It was funny. I feel like I kind of kept my cool until I met him. And then when I met him, I was like, oh my God, it's the Fresh Prince.
and he strikes me as someone like, when you meet him, like, his charisma must be enormous. Like,
oh my
were
God.
You in this just like charisma zone?
He is the most charismatic person I've ever been around. Like, not a close second.
If you were to sum up in like one line, what is kind of, other than like just natural talent or whatever, what do you think he does that kind of catapults him above the rest in terms of charisma?
Well, I'll tell you, this will serve as a little bit of a teaser for the book. So when I first met him, I spent about a week with him, and it was really just about us getting to know each other and hanging out and talking. And then at the end of the week, we would see if there was like a good book idea. And so I spent like 3 days with him. And the thing I noticed about him, and this is what I ended up telling him, is I said, look, like, you're a smart guy. You're obviously super successful. You've had a very interesting life. But the thing that you are like 99.99999 percentile is emotional intelligence. Like his ability to sense what people in the room are feeling and react fluidly without awkwardness and making everybody feel included and feel like comfortable and make everybody laugh. Like it's something that I've never seen before on that level. And to him, it's just how he is.
And I know we have a hard stop, and I know you'll come back on the podcast when that project's closer and we'll talk about it. But can you give one example where, like, because I could think of people who could do that, but give one example where it was like above and beyond.
So for instance, he was here in New York last year, and because his son Jaden was playing at MSG. And so we all went out to dinner. There was about 15 of us went out to dinner, and it was me, him, his son Jaden, and then like probably like 10 kind of random people in the recording industry, people on his team, whatever. And nobody really knew each other. And there was this kind of unspoken awkwardness because he's Will Smith. He's sitting at the table, he's paying for everything. And there's just like 10 or 15 of us just hanging out. Like, what do we say? What do we do? Like, people are nervous. And he just took control of the situation. And he was like, hey, we're going to play a game. We're going to play the three wishes game. And we're going to go around the table and we're going to talk about each other's wishes. And he made every single individual feel included. And he engaged every single person, you know, one-on-one. And it just turned into this beautiful two-hour conversation. And afterwards, I realized, I was like, wow, like he knew he had to do that. Like he knew if he didn't do that, it was going to be an awkward dinner and people were going to feel uncomfortable around him. And so he took it upon himself to organize a conversation and not make himself the center of the conversation, but make each individual feel special so that everybody enjoyed their night. And it's not premeditated. Like it's just, it's so natural to him. Like he just senses it in people and he knows what he needs to say to like make them feel comfortable and feel good.
So we'll make that the starting point of our next podcast when that book gets closer to coming out. But Everything Is Fucked, A Book About Hope by Mark Manson. When's this book coming out?
May 14th.
May 14th. It's a really great book. It was a page turner and I learned a lot, which I can't say about every single book. So thanks once again, Mark, for coming on the podcast, and I look forward to the next time.
Thanks, James. Always a pleasure.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently. At capella.edu.